As I promised earlier in the week, I've been thinking and thinking and thinking about what the message is, what we need to learn from the horrible Pittsburgh massacre, the worst anti-Semitic attack in the history of the United States. And let me say loud and clear, I'm not a prophet, lo navi, velo ben navi. But I'm just doing my responsibility as to see what I can learn and what I have to fix, and everyone else should do the same. And I'm just sharing with the ideas that I came up with, and maybe it could help someone else also. But everyone has to do their own thinking and their own analysis and look for a message for them. And I stress, everyone has to look for a message for themselves. We're not coming to Chas v'Sholom say why any tragedy befell any one of the 11 victims. Kulam Kedoshim, they all died al Kiddush Hashem. It's none of our business. Our business is to take responsibility for ourselves, right? We don't know why anything happens to anyone else because we don't know what's really going on with anybody else. Right? We don't know. We don't follow them around 24/7. We don't know what goes on in their private life. We don't know what goes on behind closed doors. We don't know and we can't know. Right? Our responsibility when we say we have to make a cheshbon ha-nefesh is literally us. Look, take a hard look at ourselves, who we do know, or at least could know if we take an honest look at ourselves. Right? And what can I learn from that? What can I improve? And in there's no mysteries. Regarding what happened to someone else, it's a mystery because there's no way you could know everything. But regarding yourself, there is no mystery. You know yourself and you know what you have to improve. And whenever you see tragedy strike, you have to ask yourself, what can I learn from there as to what I must improve? Right? So that being said, I want to share with you what I learned. And I'm sharing it with everybody because I think other people might find it meaningful, or at least it could trigger other thoughts that'll help you find something that you will find meaningful for yourselves. What do we know about this terrible tragedy? The most basic facts. We know that this terrible massacre happened in a shul, a Beit Knesset. Right, it makes no difference what the details are. We're talking about the rough concepts, the overall general concepts. Generally speaking, without getting into details, it happened in what we would call a Beit Knesset. It was during a Bris Mila, right, without getting into the details of what actually went on. Right, and it happened on a Shabbos. Right, just working with the raw concepts of Beis HaKnesses, Mila, Shabbos, and then the perpetrator was a very interesting creature, if we could say it. I guess that would be the right way to say it if it wasn't so tragic. He was a real androgynous, a kvi, suffik chaya, suffik behema, right? In the sense that he was a real kilayim. He was a real shatnez, right? He was interesting composite of opposites. Right, in the sense that he, Yimach Shemo, you would say he's a alt-right nationalist, technically, right? Especially as he was venting about the migrants, the invading the country. Right? But on the other hand, he hated Trump, very anti-Trump, didn't vote for Trump, doesn't own any Trump paraphernalia. Right? So it's very interesting, and therefore, you have the crazy situation that's going on. The left blaming the right, and the right blaming the left for this terrible massacre. Right? So the right and left playing the blame game, and it was perfectly possible for each side to play the blame game because this guy doesn't fit neatly into either category. Not a leftist, but not pro-Trump either. And I think there's something, to learn from all this, which I want to share, at least for myself, that I learned for myself, and what I learned for myself, I want to share with you. All right, so let's just analyze the raw concepts, the general concepts, I mean to say, of Mila, Shabbos, and Beis Knesses. There's a very interesting common denominator between all these three ideas. Right? The first of all, Bris Mila, right, which is the one that's most obvious, and then we'll extend it to the other two. What's most obvious about Bris Mila is, as the Rambam writes in the Mor Nevuchim, he gives more than one reason for the mitzvah of Bris Mila, but one of them, which he says perhaps might be the greatest reason, even greater than the other reason that he starts off with over there, see there, right, is that it is a sign that you belong to the Kahal HaMaminim. We wear a badge that we belong to a group. So it's an identification mark of belonging to a group, the group that believes in God, you know, and believes in the one God, right? The group that was founded by Avraham Avinu. Right? So it's a badge that we belong to the group, the Kahal HaMaminim, the group of believers. Right? It's a membership sign. And with this Rambam, I explain a very interesting halacha that we have by Bris Mila that we don't have by other positive commandments. Right? You know, we know that the primary responsibility to give a Bris Mila is upon the father of the baby. Right? So it's an interesting halacha. He defaults on his responsibility. Or God forbid, you know, the child's an orphan. The father died and wasn't able to. So Beis Din, right, the local rabbinical court, will take care of it and make sure he has a Bris Mila. V'lo yanichu orel b'Yisrael, to quote the Lashon HaRambam, they should not let there be a single orel, uncircumcised male, in Klal Yisrael. Now, it's very interesting that, you know, we don't find that Beis Din steps in to, you know, fulfill other mitzvos asay for a person who failed to do them. Right? It's a very interesting idea that Beis Din, you know, by Bris Mila, right, and I'm very happy to be corrected by it, but let's say if father doesn't do Pidyon HaBen, there's no halacha of that Beis Din will do the Pidyon HaBen. Right, that child will have to take care of it himself when he grows up and be poda himself from the Kohen, as an example. Right, it's dafka by Bris Mila, and I think the explanation, for aside from the fact that it's learned out from a pasuk, right, obviously, right, it's derived from a pasuk, but the philosophy behind this halacha that Beis Din steps in is because Beis Din represents the Jewish collective. You know, Beis Din is leadership. Right, especially in this day and age where we don't have a king, Beis Din, you know, represents the people, the power of the people. Right, so you know, and their legislative authority is, you know, is that's why they have legislative authority. They represent the people themselves. That's why they have legislative authority over the people. They represent the power of the people. Since Bris Mila has a communal aspect to it, because it's the badge you belong to the community of believers. That's why Beis Din, which is the embodiment of the community, right? You know, because they are the leadership, so they're the embodiment of the community, and because they're the embodiment of the community, that's why they are the leadership. It goes both ways, right? So that is why they step in, representing the community, right? The leadership that represents the community that they lead, right? They step in and they do the Bris Mila instead of the father. Right, because Bris Mila has to do with the fact that we belong to the Jewish collective. So the Beis Din, which represents the Jewish collective, for reasons that we explain, can step in and do the Bris Mila. Right. It's an amazing thing. And that's something well known, and we mentioned this in our other recording that we put out immediately after the horrific news. Right. But as we mentioned, you know, the Bris Mila is, you know, it's very, very you know, direct to the Jewish identity. And the Gemara, you know, the Mishnah says in the Dorim that all Jewish people, generally speaking, are called mahul, called circumcised. Even if one Jew technically did not circumcise because it was dangerous for him to undergo that procedure, mesuech of machos mila, he had brothers that died from a procedure, so we're not going to take a risk with him. So, but he still called them mohol in Hilchos Nedarim. If a person takes a neder, that he's not going to have any pleasure from anyone that's mahul. He's osur in all Jews. The term bris mila is like it's a generic term that is synonymous with being Jew. And it's for this reason that we mentioned, because the idea of a bris mila is that a person belongs to a Jewish collective, right? Belongs to the klal, and that is a good explanation behind why Beis Din can now step in and give the child a bris mila, Beis Din representing klal Yisrael. Now, a shul, I'm going from the most obvious to the less obvious. So the next up is a shul. So I alluded to it at the beginning of our remarks. A shul is called a Beit HaKnesset. Right? You know, a house of ingathering. That's a very strange term. Very, very strange term. Called a Beis Tefillah, a house of prayer. Right? But it's not called that. Right, we know that's where we daven, but it's called the Beit Knesset. It's called throughout Chazal and in the poskim. But you know what concerns us is that Chazal, you know, are very exacting in their lashon. Right, it's called a Beit Knesset, right, and this has to do with the famous communal prayer that Esther proclaimed when she and I'm already, you know. pointing towards the solution. It was a communal prayer, right? Communal prayer that Esther declared at the time of, you know, the 3-day fast, you know, to overturn the edict of Haman. Lech kenois es kol Yehudim, right? Gather together all the Jewish people. Gather them together, right? Right, What's written in the Sforim, I do believe it's in the Maral. It's in the Maral, I say, and it's in the Talmidei HaRajba, with Rabbeinu Bachaye and elsewhere. You know, I saw this idea that the power of a shul, that, and which is the reason why prayer is so potent there, right? You know, is that a shul is a place of ingathering. Right, when we are under the roof of one shul, it's a knisa. We have all gathered together, right? And it awakens the power of the Jewish collective, right? That's the power of Tefillah B'Tzibur. Tefillah B'Tzibur, we know, you know, even though, so let me illustrate with something that everyone probably knows, but nonetheless, right? Let's say no one gathers in shul. No one gathers in shul. 100 separate people will daven in each one in their own house at the same time. 100 people in 100 different houses will daven all at the same time, right? That's the way it is in one city, right? And it's 100 people, right? And in another city, under the roof of one shul, right? Only 10 people daven together, right? Those 10 people have the high level of Tefillah B'Tzibur, that they have a special grace with God, that God will accept their prayers. And the other hundreds, even though numerically there were more people davening, but since they didn't daven together, each one davened a Tefillas Yachid, right, a singular prayer, which is not called Eis Ratzon, right? It's not called that they have a special time of divine grace, even though they timed their davening exactly together. But they were all, each one in his own separate house. Even though they timed it exactly, they hit Shemona Esrei exactly the same second, there are 100 Yechidim. And it's not called Eis Ratzon. It's not called a time of grace. Whereas those 10 people, you know, only 10% of the 100, but since they gather together on one roof, that's called a Tzibur. It's called a, you know, an Eis Ratzon, right? And they have all the special things that Chazal promise when there is, when there's a Tfilas Tzibur. And that's the special Kedusha of a Beis Knesset. You know what the special Kedusha of a Beis Knesset is? Because it's a place that we get together to unite. Knesa means to unite. It doesn't mean just stam to go indoors, as the Malbim points out. The verb to just stam, go indoors, is va'asafto. Like va'asafto tol pezecha, take the lost object into your house, you know, until you find its rightful owner. That's va'asafto, right? Now, that's to go in. You know, Knesa is to come together as a unity, like Knesia L'Shem Shamayim. And that's the power of a Beis Knesset. Beis Knesset is a place to awaken our national unity. And that's what Esther was trying to do, right, to awaken our national unity, even though we were in, you know, Golus, we were in Golus Paras and Madai, you know, under Ahasuerus, we wanted to awaken our nationhood and give, and that's the power of Tefillah B'Tzibur, as Mal explains, that's why the Gemara says, the person who davens Tefillah B'Tzibur, it's as if he saved my sons from Golus and saved my Shechina from Golus, because as a tzibur, as a nation, we're directly under God. And that's the power of tzibur b'tzibur. Because here's the thing we got to remember. Right? The special covenant that the Jewish people have with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the covenant that was finalized with the giving of the Torah, right? It's a covenant of between God and the nation of Israel. And the nation of Israel. Not with the individuals. That's why God did not give the Torah to the Avos, even though the Avos were exceptional individuals. The three Avos, and so Yaakov and his 12 sons, Yaakov, Mitaso, Shlema, exceptional individuals. But individuals, as great as they are not a vessel big enough to hold the infinite Torah. You cannot make an eternal covenant with individuals who are here today and gone tomorrow. You can only make an eternal covenant, you know, with a nation, because a nation is a corporate entity that's inclusive of all Jews of all times. That's how you can make an eternal covenant with a nation. And because it's inclusive of all Jews of all times, that's a vessel big enough to hold an infinite Torah. And with this, the Maharal explains that one of the Memches Dvarim Shatar Niknes Bahem, one of the 48, tools, 48 attributes that are necessary to acquire Torah is noseh b'olim chavero, right? You have to consider yourself, carry your friend's burden together with him, right? His problem should be your problem, right? Don't let him carry his burden alone. Help him carry his load with him, right? His problem should be your problem also. And the Maharal explains, right? Because Hashem gave the Torah to a nation. So are you part of a nation or not? You want to be Konet Torah, you got to be part of a nation. What shows that you're a part of a nation is that you feel unified with the nation. His problem is your problem. Yeah? And that's the unique Kedusha of the Beis HaKnesses, the Sfarim explains, sorry, in the Rishonim. Right? The special Kedusha of the Beis HaKnesses is not that we daven there. That's the derivative. The special Kedusha basically is a place of Knesa, of where we gather together. It brings out our national unity. And once we are a nation, as a nation, we have a special direct line to God. And Mimela, we daven there. Mimela, that's what we should do, because when we reveal our nationhood by bringing 10 Jews together, the spirit of a nation is awakened. And that's what the Ramak explains. The 10th man that comes gets schar kulam. He gets the reward of everybody, even if a million people come after him. He gets the reward of everybody, including the million that come after him. That's what it sounds like. And he says, because once you have 10, you have infinite. Because the 10th man closes the circuit and the nationhood is awakened. And once the nationhood is awakened, it's inclusive of all Jews everywhere. And that's the power of a Beis HaKnesses. The power of the Beis HaKnesses is that it's a place to get together and awaken our national ethos, our national unity. And Mimela, that's where you should daven. Because Hashem has a covenant to immediately accept the prayers of the Jewish people, not Jewish individuals. Jewish individuals, each one is on his own merit. You know, where we get a free passes as a nation, because as a nation, we have a covenant with him. And finally, what's a little bit less obvious, but also fits into this, is Shabbos, right? On Shabbos, we are meant to all be in Roshus HaYochid. On Shabbos, you're supposed to make an Eruv. You're supposed to combine. No one should be in separate domains. We should be a single, unified domain. Now, you could be in separate domains, but life will be difficult for you. You won't be able to carry. You could only carry in a unified domain. That's even between two single domains, right? Between two individually owned houses. Each one is its own singular domain. But you have to unite the two through an Eruv and make them a unified domain. And there's something very great, greatly significant in that. Shabbos is a day of, being together with the one God, acknowledging that the one God created all. So it's a day where oneness is demanded, like the Zohar says. All right, that's the secret that we're not allowed to carry in a public domain. We don't want public. We want unity. So you could carry on normal life, which involves moving things around, right? You can only in a unified Rishus HaYochid. Rishus HaYochid. And, there's a lot. This is a very deep idea. Like I said, Shabbos is the least obvious of the three. But another hint to this is that we know the high point of Shabbos is Shalosh Shudas. That is the high point, the crescendo, right? The high point, the apex, the climax, right, of Shabbos is when we come to Suda Shlishis, which we're supposed to ideally eat right after Mincha. That's called the Shav Rava, the Ravin. There's just tremendous divine grace at that time. So what do we say in Shabbos Mincha? Ata Echad V'shimcha Echad Umi Ka'amcha Yisrael Goy Echad Bartz. You're one, your name's one, who's like one nation, meaning a unified nation. We're Goy Echad. No other nations unified like Am Yisrael is unified. And that unity that we have, that special bond that there is between Jews, is a spiritual bond that comes from God's one name, which is the Torah, which comes from God himself, who is one. Right? And that's revealed on Shabbos. And with this, we could understand a Gemara. There's a Gemara in Yevamos Daf Yud Daled. And we're going to refer to that Gemara, in a minute, we're going to just dwell on that Gemara for quite a while. Right? But the Gemara over there says, the Gemara is talking about the Isra of Losis Godadu. Right? The prohibition, we should not allow the Torah to splinter into separate religions. So even though there's machlokes, inevitably, Beis Shammai, Beis Hillel is the example over there that the Gemara is dealing with. Right? We have to take care, losis godu, lotasu, agudos, right? Don't splinter into separate groups. Don't let the Torah splinter into different religions. Got to keep it unified. So even if there's going to be dispute, right, and the all types of machlo, differences of opinion, make sure it stays one religion, despite the differences of opinion, right? So the Gemara over there has a havamina, right, that therefore we should not allow any disputes regarding the laws of Shabbos. Everyone should always be in total agreement as far as all Hilchos Shabbos, right? The case in point of the Gemara was, there was a machlokas Rabbi Elazar and the Chachamim. Rabbi Elazar holds that, not only does bris mila, interesting, it has to do with the tragedy. Bris mila is docha Shabbos. You could do a bris mila on Shabbos, like what happened in Pittsburgh. Right? So that's a halacha everyone agrees upon. But Rabbi Elazar holds that not only can you do the bris itself, you can even cut down trees to make coals, to melt metal, to make a mila knife for a bris mila on Shabbos. You're allowed to do absolutely anything and everything involved in performing a bris on Shabbos, including all the melachas necessary to create the mila knife that you use to make the bris. Right? Obviously, we don't paskin that way. We don't paskin that way. Right? So now the Gemara explains that, that machlokas endured because Rabbi Elazar he was rabbi of his town, and in his town they did his way, and everywhere else did else. Yeah, and that's how, and that's a way that we get around the prohibition of not letting the Torah splinter, right, mekomos mekomos shiny, right? Different towns are allowed to have different rulings, right? Which is the case today. I mean, now it's more complicated because there's been a great absorption into America from all the communities around the old world, and in Israel also from all the communities around the old world. And indeed, there's a lot of fighting and dissent because of all different minhagim. But once upon a time, it was considered to be okay because every town is like its own little, its own little fiefdom, whatever you want to call it. So it's permissible. But the Gemara had a havamina that by Shabbos it should be intolerable, even in separate places, Mishum chumer to Shabbos, because the stringency of Shabbos. We should not tolerate any differences in halacha regarding Hilchos Shabbos, even if those differences are carried out in two different towns. Shouldn't be tolerated. The Gemara, backs down from that. But what was the Gemara thinking? What was that Chumrah de Shabbos that overrides the heter of Mekomos, Mekomos Shani, that overrides the principle that the Torah could be practiced differently, if they're both legitimate views, equally academically legitimate, it could be practiced differently if it's in different places. Well, that doesn't apply to Shabbos. And then the Gemara decides it does apply to Shabbos. But what was the Gemara thinking? Because Shabbos is a day of absolute unity. And just like separate places should all be bound by an Eruv to become one. Shabbos is a day of unity, and we should not tolerate any type of disputes in the laws of Shabbos, because Shabbos should be a day of absolute unity. So the answer is that, well, it is a day of absolute unity, but nonetheless, the principle of Mekomos Shiny does apply, and two different towns could have two different rulings, Legabe Hilchos Shabbos, and it's not a problem of Los is go to do. So that, you know, so one thing is for sure, there's a very solid common denominator between all the Jewish elements of that happening that were involved in this tragedy. It's also about Klal Yisrael, that we are one nation. We are one nation. We are one nation. And of course, therefore, we have to focus on unity. Right? But now let's look at what there is to learn from the vile animal, Suffolk Chaya, Suffolk Behema, right? The Kvi, you know, the Trump-hating right-wing lunatic, right? What there is to learn, right? You know, we're one nation and we only have each other. We don't have, in the long term, we don't have friends, not on the right and not on the left, right? I know I issued another audio, which I do not regret anything I said there, because as I stressed over there, for the time being, in my opinion, and I'm going to get more about the idea, concept of my opinion in just a second. In my opinion, right, currently, at this point in time in our history, right, our ally at this point in time is the Republican Party and President Donald J. Trump. And generally speaking, the right side of the political spectrum. But that is in this point in time. I know that long term, we only have one person, only one thing, you know, whatever you want to call it, only one to rely on. That's Hashem himself, right? And until then, we're going to be like a ping pong ball being shot. We have like 2,000 years worth of experience regarding this, right? You know, at one point in time, you know, by the early Rishonim, right, Western Europe was a great place where Torah was thriving, right? Spain, Germany, you know, in Germany, Rashi and Tosfos, and Spain, even after the Rambam, you know, so then there was the Moors, you know, but then it flipped to being Christian, and there was this another golden age. You know, there's the old golden age of the Rif, the Rimigash, the Rambam, and then the Moors, you know, made it a lousy place, but then it became Christian, and we had the, you know, Ramban, Rabbeinu Yoina, the Rajba, the Ritva, the Ran, yeah, et cetera, right? So at one point, you know, the Western Europe was, you know, where Torah was flourishing. Then things got really bad there, right? So, and we moved eastwards, right? So there are those from Spain went further east to like Turkey, and then, you know, Eretz Yisrael, you know, and the, Arab countries, you know, and the Jews from Ashkenaz, you know, went eastward as far as, you know, Poland, Russia, Lithuania, those type of places, right? And then that's where Torah flourished, right? And then things went the other way, right? Times became tough over there in Eastern Europe, so Jews moved back to Western Europe, where Jews were granted, you know, equal rights, particularly after Napoleon, right? That's where, you know, not going to talk about whether they flourished spiritually in Western Europe, but there was just a great deal of tolerance and acceptance of the Jews as human beings, seemingly, right? And then came the Holocaust, and in Western Europe became a bloodbath that extended to Eastern Europe also, right? So it's been a ping pong. We've been a ping pong ball for the last 2,000 years, from the right side to the left side to the right side, you know? And when the Christians seemed to be kind of disposed to us, and when the Moors weren't, that flipped, and then, you know, the Christians were the worst to us, and we found refuge by the, you know, the Arabs, and vice versa. You know, up, down, all around. Right? So we know we don't have any long-term friends, and that's one message. We only have each other, and we only have HaKadosh Baruch Hu, obviously, and who is the secret of our year. Just like he's one God, we're one nation. We are. We, the Jewish people, are the one nation under God. The real one nation under God. And he's the only one. He's the only one one that we can rely on, and we only have each other. And even though I do not regret a thing that I said, I still hold that at this point in time, we are our current allies in America and worldwide is the right wing of the spectrum. Right? But I acknowledge that that's temporary, like it's been for the last 2,000 years almost. You have 2,000 years worth of experience knowing, you know, it's a good ride for now, for now. And I know that. And I alluded to that in my previous audio. right? But so number one, we have to realize in the long run, no friends, not on the right and not on the left. But there's something else to look at over here. That, you know, you have the right and left blaming each other. You know, and this is an ideal situation for them to do so, because the guy on one hand hated Trump, so call him, you know, a leftist, you know, because he's anti-Trump. The left say, well, you know, he's a neo-Nazi, white supremacist, so he's on the right. You know, blaming each other and making political gains out of our tragedy, like we mentioned in last audio. All right, horrible. Horrible, right? We have to make sure that we don't get caught up in it. Because sadly, I'm sure everyone is appalled by what I said in this audio and certainly by what I said in the previous audio, meaning Jews who are leftists, you know, think that Donald Trump is, you know, the greatest evil in the world. Now, of course, I disagree with them vehemently, right? But what I have learned from this tragedy is that even if you think I'm dead wrong and I think you're dead wrong, right? We are one people. We cannot let the divide between right and left that's ripping up the world right now and pushing the whole world to civil war. Mark my words, right? You heard it here first, but you probably thought of it even before I said it, right? The next world war is going to be a worldwide civil war of right versus left. This division of right and left is ripping through not just the fabric of American society. Oh, it's been going on in Israel even before America, all right? And it's going through Europe, right? The world is going to divide into teams of right and left. We have to make sure that's not going to happen to us, that we're not going to get caught up in that fray. We're Yisrael, right? We're Yisrael, we're Yesharim, we're right down the middle. We take the best from both sides. We take the best that both sides have to offer, right? And we're not going to be on any one side. And when this happens, you know, and it's already hit the fan, right? But it's only going to get worse, mark my words. You know, we have to make sure that we're not going to get swept up in this. So even if I'm going to argue for the right and another of my fellow Jews is going to argue for the left, right? He thinks I'm wrong. I think he's wrong. We still have to stay one people and look for the common denominator. Without me in any way being required to back down from anything that I say, and without him being required to back down from anything he says. Let's go back to that Gemara in Yevamos, right? The Sugya of Losis Godadu, right? The prohibition of not letting the Torah splinter into different religions, and which would mean that the Jewish people, God forbid, would splinter into different peoples. Right? That's prohibited. So how did the Gemara get into that discussion? Because, you know, Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had a very severe, severe dispute. That this dispute alone could have ripped up the nation, if not for the fact that Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai were bigger people. Right? Much bigger people than us, obviously. They had a machlokas of chayve krisus. Right, the case was yibum, right? You know, you're not allowed to marry your brother's wife. But the Torah gave a special dispensation if the brother died without children. He was married, died without children. You could marry his wife to perpetuate his name. But that's if he died without children. If he had children, to marry his wife is a cardinal sin, which is chayv kores. And the child from such a union would be a mamzer, a bastard that can't marry a regular Jew. God forbid. Right? Question, the machlokas between Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel was the following scenario. Right? The man was married to two wives. Right? And he had no children from either of them. One of them was his brother's own daughter. He married his niece, which is permitted. He married his niece, right? His brother's daughter. Right? That was one of the wives. And there was another wife that was totally unrelated to anyone in the family. And he dropped dead without any kids. So Beis Hillel says you obviously are not allowed to marry your own daughter, God forbid. So obviously you can't do Yibum and marry your own daughter, even though your brother died without kids, because your daughter. But Basil says that so she's an Erva. The Tsoras Erva, the co-wife, also, just like the daughter is off the hook. She doesn't have to marry. She's not going to have to marry her father, obviously. It's prohibited. So just like she is off the hook, so also the co-wife is off the hook, and she doesn't have to marry that brother. If the only living brother was the father of one of the wives, as per example, then the other one is off the hook. They just call the Tsaras Erva. And it's talking about when there is no other brothers in the household that both wives can marry. Okay? So once one's off the hook, they're all off the hook. That was the opinion of Beis Hillel, who obviously we paskin like. We always rule like Beis Hillel. Right? Beis Shammai Matir, and that's what Beis Shammai says, all right, don't marry your daughter, marry the other one. And Beis Hillel says, no, once we rule that she doesn't have to do Yibum, then she goes back to being prohibited with the regular prohibition of a brother's wife. Because once the special dispensation, it doesn't apply, then the serious capital offense of kares, right, of marrying your brother's wife applies. So what Beis Shammai would consider a mitzvah, oh, you're doing the mitzvah of doing Yibum on the other one, that's not your daughter, as per our example, right? So Beis Shammai says you're doing a mitzvah. Beis Hillel says you're doing a terrible sin, which is chayiv kares, and the product of that union is a mamzer. Right? Yeah. Ooh, that's big. Right? And you know what? The Mishnah goes on to say they stayed friends. They stayed friends. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel. They argued. They stayed friends. And not only that, they intermarried. Right? So the Gemara first thought and said, well, maybe Beis Shammai didn't follow through on their ruling. But the Gemara does conclude and proves they followed through. Oh, and they did it. They did these unions, you know, which they considered a mitzvah, and Beis Hillel considered a cardinal sin. They did it. And you know what? They, even though they had a bitter disagreement, I say bitter in terms of content, not bitter on a personal level. That's the point. They weren't bitter on a personal level. It was a bitter conflict, you know, academically, that what one considers a mitzvah, one considers a cardinal sin, and regarding the product of that union, one considers it a bastard that can't marry into the nation, right? You know what? They still held it together. And you know what? They intermarried. But what does it mean they intermarried? So the Gemara explains and qualifies. Not that Beis Shammai said, out of love for us, you're going to have to back down from your stringent position that you consider some of our kids bastards. No, they didn't demand that from Beis Hillel. They did not demand it from Beis Hillel. But no, they just said, look, Beis Hillel, this girl, according to your understanding, is a bastard. All right, don't marry her. But this girl, that's no problem. So let's do a shidduch, that boy to this girl, because you would agree that that's a permitted union. They looked for the common higher ground. But they didn't demand from each other to submit to their view, right? You know, that the famous saying says, why fight? Just do it my way. That wasn't that way with Beis Hillel and Beis Shammai. They each did it their own way. And they didn't, and out of love for each other, they didn't say, if you love me, you'll do it my way. No, they didn't say that. They said, I love you and you do it your way, right? You know, I think you're wrong. I think you're wrong, but you'll do it your way and I have to swallow that. And you think I'm wrong, but I'm going to do it my way and you're going to have to swallow that. But here's a boy and girl that could marry according to both of our opinions. So let's look for the common denominator and hold it together. So this is what I say, right? Mark my words, this country, right, and the whole world is about to be ripped up with the bitter war between right and left. It's only getting worse and worse and worse, with each side blaming the other for the toning up the rhetoric, right? Each one accusing the other one of blaming, but, you know, just it's escalating. It's escalating. And even though I firmly believe at this point in time, we have to throw in with the right, throw in with the Republican, throw in Trump, and I think anyone who thinks otherwise is dead wrong, and is doing something that's going to be, if he does otherwise and throws him with the left, he's going to bring about the fall of America and the fall of and ruin the security state. You know, I think that. But I have to swallow the fact that there are Jews that disagree with me and think I'm dead wrong and I'm the one that's destroying, you know, society, right? I believe in the Torah min haShemayim, and I believe in all the, unapologetically, in all the mitzvahs of the Torah, including the ones in Sefer Vayikra, Book of Leviticus, right? That the liberals would say are terribly, insensitively intolerant. I don't care. I believe it's the Word of God. And I'm unapologetic about it, just like I'm unapologetic, lavdil, right? Unapologetic about the fact that, you know, we have to throw in, at this point in time, I stress, at this point in time, long term, we only have God. Long term, we only have each other. And that's my point. But I believe at this point in time, we're thrown at the right side, right? The people on the left, Jews on the left, have to swallow that and accept me for who I am. And I have to swallow the fact that they disagree with me on these very fundamental issues, you know, political issues, and even more fundamentally on Torah issues. I got to swallow that. There's nothing I can do about it. I have to swallow that, just like they have got to swallow the fact that I think the way I do, and we have to find the higher common ground. Because real love is not to demand that the other one give in to your point of view. Real love is to accept the person for who they are, and if that person also is reciprocating with real love, he accepts you for who you are, and you look for the common ground. Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel had this bitter on an academic, you know, philosophical level, you know. A terrible thing. Is it a chi of karis or is it a mitzvah? That's big. That's it. A machlokas doesn't get more polarized than that. You know, is this child going to be a chi of mitzvah? Is this child going to be a mamzer? It doesn't get more polarized than that, right? And they still found a way to live together in total love and harmony, you know, without relinquishing their positions. They just look for the common denominator. That's what we have to do, and that is the message, right? And that's why it happened at this time, as the country is ripping itself up, you know, and the whole world's ripping itself up in the strife between right and left with the elections just next week, right? And I have my opinion, which I have already stated, right? And others have, you know, a diametrically opposed opinion. We are all one people. We have to make sure we, the Jewish people, stay one people. And that involves us swallowing each other's differences of opinion, right? Accepting that and choosing the higher common ground, because we are one people and we need each other to be that mega vessel called a nation, right? That has the special relationship with Hashem, and which is the vessel, the only vessel big enough to hold Hashem's Torah. So for the sake of that higher good, got to find a higher common neighbor and stick together and not get caught up in the waging war between right and left. We got to find our higher common ground that's above the fray.